as much as I do feel like I'm walking on a certain path, and I'm always choosing where the path is or what the path is, I really think all of this is just the art that we're making in our lives, in our little houses, in our little spaces. And it's not necessarily leading in any certain direction except to make us more aware of the meaning and the beauty in our world.
Hi, I'm Derek Mills. Welcome to the GLOW podcast. Elena Brower is a dear friend of mine and of GLOW. You may have already discovered her movement and meditation classes on GLOW since we've been working together since 2009. She is also a mentor, poet, artist, and best-selling author. Her books include The Art of Attention, Being You, and Practice You. Her latest is a book of poetry called Softening Time, Collected Poems. She also hosts a podcast also called Practice You. We discuss her recent book, her newsletter, where she publishes personal stories and miniature memoirs. We discuss her hospice work, Buddhism, and long meditation sessions, why consistent practice is so helpful for a daily life, a lovely encounter with a GLOW member, and a brief note on parenting towards the end. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Elena. Elena, so great to be here with you.
What a treat, brother. It's been so long.
So, you know, since starting GLOW back in 2008, this has been a journey of many twists and turns, as you know. And I want to thank you for your friendship along the way. And I also appreciate our business relationship that we've cultivated over all of these years. And I know our GLOW members and GLOW team highly appreciate you as well and your teaching. So a huge, huge many year thank you.
Bowing deeply, in case you can't see me, listener, this has been one of the most consistently satisfying aspects of my professional life for all these years. And I think I started with you. It must have been 2009, 2010.
Yes.
Right at the beginning.
It had to be 2009 because I remember telling you about Lisa when we first met. So
that's right.
And I met Lisa that's in right. February of 2010. Yeah.
Wow. I remember our first conversation. Actually, I was in my apartment at the time in New York City and could not wrap my head around the fact that I was going to be teaching to a camera. I was very resistant and you were very persistent. And it worked out. Thank God.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. If there's one thing I am, it's persistent.
Yes. You were sure. And your certainty really helped. It made a difference in mine.
Well, so thank you for believing in me, in us, through all the twists and turns. It means a lot. Thank you.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. You're welcome. And thank you.
We have a lot to get through today. I have more notes than will allow us in the time that we have. I'll start off. You know, you're an incredible podcast host, and I recommend everyone listen to your episodes, your show, Practice You. I took one of your recent classes on GLOW this morning. It's titled Curious and Creative Flow. And I'm going to quote you here. Yeah. Well, curiosity is going to be a theme of our discussion. And so I'm going to quote you here. I'm going to quote you a lot actually today.
Okay.
You said, "What is this day requesting of me? What can I be more curious about? Perhaps less assuming or judgmental." Then later on towards the end, you ask, "Can you stay in your curiosity and creativity around what this day is asking of you? Notice where your mind wanders, also what is beneath it, that steady presence, the source of your creative force." Speaking of themes, I want to touch on curiosity, creativity, steady presence, and the source of your creative force. Before you comment on that, speaking of curiosity, when I think about you, when I think about the many aspects I appreciate about you, is that you're an educator, but you're insatiably curious. You're a fellow learner. You are constantly making art from your teaching, your wonder, awe, curiosity, and your continuous learning. And as with any great art, you take us, the listener, the reader, the viewer, you know, through a process that, you know, feels as though we're on this journey with you, and we're learning and exploring together. And instead of telling us, your art ultimately is inviting us to engage our inner lives. And let's not forget the hidden parts too, that are hard to face often. And, you know, in so doing, you invite us to explore in expanded possibilities of ourselves. And I know that's a mouthful, but it's something that I truly feel and appreciate about what you create.
Thank you so much for noticing that. And it is definitely what I aim to do, which is, I don't really know all that much. What I know is that I'm constantly learning. And if I can bring my reader, listener, practitioner along on my path to understanding, you know, in some illustrative fashion, then I've done my job. Yeah.
In terms of what that job is, one of the questions I love asking GLOW teachers on the podcast is, do you have a favorite story of a GLOW member approaching you in person? Like someone that you've never met before.
I do, and sharing.
I know you have hundreds, if not thousands, but in terms of like what that job is that you're accomplishing or producing, or, you know, that creative work that is having an impact on people, like, I wonder if you could share a story that also maybe includes or unpacks that a little bit.
Yeah, I actually have a few of those, but there's one that stands out. Gal that I met, we'll call her B. I think her first name started with a B, in a very distant airport somewhere in Europe. And she literally just came barreling up to me in the sweetest way and told me that my classes on GLOW had changed the way she looks at her parents by some miracle, and her family in general, but her parents specifically. I don't know that I've ever mentioned anything about parents in a class. I'm sure that I haven't, in fact. But I think what she's picking up on, what she was picking up on when she approached me, was my intent to sort of get everything and everyone into one human container and not forsake each other, you know, to keep ourselves together, to always at the end of practice dedicate the merits to someone else who might be in need, suffering, struggling, and to sort of keep our awareness on all the parts of our lives without getting too sucked in. You know, sort of my teacher wrote a book called Standing at the Edge, and sort of standing always at the edge of all of the qualities, these pro-social qualities that you want to cultivate, one wants to cultivate, always standing right at the edge, keeping your practice close so that you never go over the edge, and you're always at your kind of high edge of these qualities. And I think that's what she was sort of effusing when she came up to me. It was just the sweetest thing, and she ended up being on my flight, and we ended up chatting, and the landscape of her life was such that she had no local teacher. And, you know, in essence, GLOW is her studio. And that was a great gift for her that we gave to her collectively. So, yeah, there are many sweet stories like that. And most of them weirdly take place in airports or in shops, like random shops. I'll be in a shop somewhere and somebody will come up to me and just say, "Hey, are you Elena Brower?" I'll be like, Mm-hmm. How are you doing? You know, give me a hug. How are you? What's your name? So sweet.
So sweet.
It's, you know, you could look at it as, oh, that's so special, whatever. It's actually very ordinary, you know? It's just like seeing your teacher out and about, and very sweet to say hello, and instead of to just gloss over it. I appreciate it.
Yeah, those are some of my favorite stories. The stories where there's an expression of not just the evolution or the exploration within oneself, but then how that follows on to one's immediate surroundings. Mm. And I've always wondered if we could come up with a way to measure, you know, not just the impact on an individual's evolution, but then also on those around them. Because I'm sure whatever it is that she was experiencing or working with was likely influencing the behavior of her parents in some way. And you know, we hear that often. I love that. If I were to look back at all of the sort of naive dreams I had for Glow on day one,
right,
that would be up there probably in the top three for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Knowing that when spending some time with people like you, it can't help but influence the world around you.
It's very sweet. I pass that off to my teachers too, because their only mission is to help us create this sort of one body. And, you know, hopefully I'm passing that along. I can't really take credit for what happens in there. And I'm sitting, by the way, on purpose, right in front of where I record so that you can see.
Mm-hmm.
It's right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's
and nobody
backdrop.
Messes with it now. James leaves it alone. We got rid of our sofa. We might get another one, but one that we can move easily, because we kind of like having that there as kind of a focal point in the living room / my office. Mm-hmm. It's really funny.
It is funny. I think the words you used exactly was that people leave it alone. The behaviors or the routines that I want to maintain consistently, I need to make it as easy as possible. So like,
correct.
I leave a mat out in a spot. I'm fortunate and privileged enough to have a little area where I can just leave that mat and almost never roll it up unless I'm cleaning.
Yeah.
So I get that.
Yeah. It's very
sweet.
Don't touch
my stuff.
Don't touch my stuff. Leave my stuff alone.
You know, you were mentioning earlier pro-social behavior and practicing at the edge. It made me think of a few lines in a few of the poems that you wrote in your most recent book. And I was going to save your book for the end, but I think maybe now is a good time to go there. As a lead-in, this concept of practicing at the edge, I wrote down a few examples that I'd love to read back to you.
Sure.
Do you want to tee off what the book is and why you wrote it before I do that or after I do that?
I'm happy to. Yeah, I'm happy to. It's a collection of poetry called Softening Time. There's no telling if anything like this is ever going to happen again, although I will continue writing poetry. It's indicative of the season I'm in, which is softening. And softening with regards to my own mistakes and failures, softening with regards to everyone around me, softening with regards to reality as it presents itself to me when it's difficult, especially. And this, several of the poems are actually quite old, and they were started 10, 20 years ago and then finished over the last few years. And several of them are brand new, and there's a whole section in the back that is dedicated to certain people. Each one of those pieces is an homage to a friend or a relative or someone who's influenced me. So it's very sweet to get to talk about it. It's not very often that I do, and it's very sweet to get to talk about it because I really loved the process of writing it and delivering it to the world.
Why won't it ever happen again?
Unknown. The next book I'm writing is much more personal. Being on Substack has sort of loosened up my writing a little bit so that I'm more willing to be more personal. The poems are so very vague in certain regards, and certain regards they're really not. But writing more literally prose along with paintings, prompts, that's where I'm going next. The book is, the working title is Coming Home or Come Home to Yourself, and it will be published by Shambhala probably 2025. So that's what I'm working on now. So I don't know. I mean, maybe another poetry book. Let's see.
I love how it goes forwards and backwards in time, and it interweaves. You don't specifically call out or mention the subject, the person that you're referring to or that it's about, but you tend to get a sense, and you see them entering, leaving, and then reemerging. And there's some that I won't even refer to because I'll start crying. They were just so beautiful. And we could spend the rest of this time together psychoanalyzing why, for me, sure. They're so powerful.
I'd be into that.
Yeah, I would be too. I'll just give you one taste, like the dear 7-year-old self.
Oh God, hiding under the bed.
Oh, that, you know, I'm getting tears just thinking about it. I need to write that. I want to write that for myself.
You know, when I teach writing, I always go to situations like that where I'll say, okay, that's my 7-year-old self. Where's yours? Mm-hmm. And people do that. You might as well do that. As a matter of course, send it to me because it will serve you. It will be very healing to find out where that 7-year-old boy is. Where is he?
No question.
What's he doing? Well,
after many years of therapy, I have a much better sense of where he's at, what he did, and why.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
And what he's continuing to do.
And I'm assuming that you've sort of welcomed him and all of his being back into your life in some way, in a supportive way.
No, not enough. That's why it's so emotional for me. Mm-hmm. There are ways in which that he, and I also think of him as a plural he, not just a singular he.
Sure.
You know, it was stunted, and you know. Maybe lost some innocence a little too early. And so, yeah, there definitely is a creative force there that is wanting to be expressed.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of wisdom, and I've heard this a lot from many different teachers and traditions and schools, parts work with Richard, but welcoming that human, like visually and energetically, into your own arms as you are now, knowing what you know now, having been through all this work on yourself now, is such a healing. And you could even just do it in a yoga nidra or do it in a seated meditation where you can just see yourself at 7 walking toward yourself. What would you do? Like, I would take that little girl and I would put her into my arms like this. She would be way too big for my lap. Her legs would be trailing off to the side. I've pictured this many, many times, just holding her, kind of rocking her a little bit like a baby. Now you know what that's like. Or stroking her little hair, little side part that she had, you know. That feels so good to me. And it is sad. And tears do fall. And that's part of the process, I think.
Yeah. Thank you. Like you said, we could spend this whole next 30 minutes just on that. But to my point at the top, I want to make sure we get in a few more nuggets of genius from you and with you. You said earlier the softening when difficult. It struck me that is probably what that young woman who approached you was expressing is in difficult moments with parents, you know, that like, what are the ways in which we can soften and look at ourselves, you know, when we're sort of reflexively judging or assuming. And there's something that I want to get to. You mentioned your Substack earlier. We'll link to that as well, because I highly recommend everyone jump into that. It will be time very well invested. I guarantee it. I don't know where this is going exactly, but so I mentioned I was going to quote a few lines from your book. So in the poem currently, there's a line where you say, "Resting my exhausted certainties."
Oh, and God, then, yes.
And then in faith, the strongest force is not gravity. It is curiosity, a holy map to that which you are healing within yourself. What if you are just here to develop faith in yourself? And then in "You Are All Women," "You are all women when you listen to yourself in new ways and your reality unswervingly changes."
Yeah.
So I wonder if we can hold those concepts and transition into a very recent Substack post where you say, "I'm here to cultivate a mind of safety, a mind I can trust when my heart aches. All I have to do is commit to practice. I still have no idea what I'm doing, but I'm starting to see what it means to trust my inner life, to build a sheltering mind." And all of that refers to the lines I read earlier, this idea of resting exhausted certainties, the strongest force being curiosity, and that, you know, really we're all women when we listen to ourselves in new ways and our reality becomes unswervingly changed. I love that. Like, change is to swerve.
Totally.
But yet we're unswervingly changing, staying on the path of continuous change. I'm assuming that's what you meant by that.
Yes, that is what I meant. Yeah. The only constant is change. The only thing that doesn't change is the fact that everything is changing.
Right.
It's so Buddhist.
That, perfect.
You know, yeah, it's really funny. It's like almost a caricature in a way.
Right. It's a little too on the nose, I guess, is what you mean by that. Mm-hmm. Can you talk to us about that? Because that, if you look at your recent Substack post, that there's a lot that you're sharing about that whole journey, you know, the extended sitting periods and the service and, I would love to know more about all of that.
You know, it's hard to really pinpoint when it became a definite situation, but when we moved here in 2020 to New Mexico, and I saw the second day we moved here, the sign for Upaya Zen Center, I had a very visceral reaction. Tears were falling. My heart was blasted open. I couldn't go in because of COVID. There was a sign, you know, "Please look us up online." And I instantly started studying there. One of the Substacks I wrote called Silent Illumination is a really good sort of summation of that process. I think I've taken over 200 online programs at Upaya and no stopping. I think what really helps the most is this point that everything is always changing, that I have to get comfortable with it, that I can also, in my leveling up of comfort with change, can also share that without words with my kid, who's now 17 and going to college next year, by the way. Remember that little nugget running around the Glow Studio?
Yes, such a sweetheart. Congratulations.
And he's the best.
And a successful, rewarding job as a parent.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting, slight tangent. One of his friends was really injured. An acquaintance of his was really injured yesterday on the ski slope. And I thought, you know, everything is always changing. This could just flip in an instant. And
just
you never know. And the whole sort of, impetus toward Buddhism for me, toward Zen in particular, is that preparedness for the inevitability of change. And that feels really important to me. And I feel, you know, I've gotten now very close to death. I'm working in hospice. I'm working with grieving kids. There's no limit to the suffering in the world. And I used to look at Buddhism and the Four Noble Truths and go, God, it's so dark. I don't want anything to do with that. And now I'm like, of course I resisted it. That's exactly where I needed to go. There is no escape from suffering. There is no escape from old age. There is no escape from illness. There is no escape from death. So how am I going to sort of stand on that threshold between what is true, suffering, and total freedom from my crazy mind and the creation of a sheltering mind, as you quoted? And I think that's why I'm studying in this tradition. And I'm actually going on a pilgrimage this year with my teacher in April to Japan for multiple weeks. I'm so excited I could burst.
Love Japan.
Yeah. Oh my God. What a place. I took Jonah last year and we just about died. We were both just floored by how comfortable and at home we felt there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand that.
But yeah, to answer your question, this just makes every bit of sense to me. This idea that you could, as a matter of course, in this tradition, my job is to stay awake, to release all of the ambition and specialness and success, and instead just focus on service and what I can do to really make a difference in my community quietly.
I too, when I first saw that all life is suffering, is being a bit dark and pessimistic and cynical. And you know, as the years go by and I can see potentially fewer years ahead of me than were behind me, depending on how science and AI evolves, that's debatable, potentially.
Totally.
For the first time in human history. I remarked to Lisa when we left my parents last, I said, it's just, it's never enough. Like the people you love, the people, you know, whether it be family, friends, or an environment, a place, it's never enough. You can never get enough of it. And that's just, it's suffering.
Totally. There are so many more ways to look at suffering than the way that we were raised to look at suffering. In this society, we were raised to think of suffering as a failure.
Right.
That's some fault of yours. And in fact, suffering is like just a fact. There's no escaping those truths. And so, you know, how are you gonna work with it? How are you gonna flourish in the face of that? How are you gonna keep your mind safe?
Right. I was brought up in a culture where suffering was to be avoided, glossed over, numbed
at all costs,
scoffed at. Only people who are having quote unquote issues are suffering, you know, and so on and so on.
Yeah.
All of which wasn't helpful.
No. And also just created for us within us this like dark divide where there's the bad part and then there's the good part. And that walking along the hallway in school with both feels like a terrible, fraudulent existence. Walking along in any place. And until you realize that actually there is no, you know, this is all one organism and there are parts that need to be looked at. There are parts that are wonderful in the eyes of your teachers and your parents. And then these other parts that are actually totally natural human feelings, truths. Don't run away from those. Keep those close. Those are your strengths. And your allies and the way forward, really. I was listening to a talk recently and my teacher was referencing the Blue Cliff Record, which is a book of koans or sort of stories that were copied down by our Zen ancestor, Eihei Dogen, right before he left China to go to Japan to bring the teachings home. And this is case 14. It's really, really short. She gave a whole talk on it, and it's called An Appropriate Response. And the koan goes, a monk asked, I don't remember the names of the characters. There are always two characters, and it's always a wonderful thing to look into the characters and see who's who and what relationship they had, teacher, student, brother, whatever. A monk asked, what are the teachings of a lifetime? What is the most important teaching? It's translated many different ways. And the answer, an appropriate response. And sometimes an appropriate response is like, how are you? How are you doing today? And sometimes an appropriate response is some sort of like, let me send you this podcast. Let me give you this book. Let me tell you about this thing that I learned. And sometimes it's just silence and presence.
I love that. In one of your Substack posts, I forgot which one it was, you referred to a person who was experiencing something, you know, quite profound and transformative. And she asked the teacher, how do I hold on to this? And the teacher said, by giving it away.
It was so sweet.
I think that's what you mean by the appropriate response.
Yeah, totally. Totally. And that actually, interestingly, that was done in a setting where Fushin was becoming the Shuso, and the Shuso was sort of the head trainee for a certain period of practice. And he had no prescribed notes or anything. Every single person in the room had to ask him a question. And that was what he said. You know, how do I hold on to this feeling? I've been meditating for 2 weeks straight. I feel so good. What do I do? And he was just like, give that feeling away. Mm-hmm. And it was so beautiful. All of us were kind of like, huh. Well, pretty great. Good work, dude. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Indeed.
Indeed. You've mentioned a few times parts work or different parts of self. And there's a book that I read, I think it came out in 2020, called Your Symphony of Selves by, I think, James Fadiman and Jordan Gruber. And
yes,
they talk about what it means to consider the self as a, you know, not a unitary self, but a multiplicity of selves, as actually being more healthy than a conceived unitary self. Multiplicity of selves not being multiple personality disorder. There's a very clear distinction between the two, the clinical scenario. So I'm all over that.
Yeah, an amalgam.
Especially with dreaming. I'd love to ask you about dreaming.
That's such a good one. I've only just now really started to pay attention and take notes on my dreams. And boy, do I get some good information in those things. Gosh, particularly the ones that are coming close to the morning.
Is there anything you'd like to share about that in terms of how dreams are informing the work that you're currently doing?
You know, I find myself making lots of weird mistakes in my dreams and like doing strange things that I wouldn't do in real life, IRL. And I have come to understand that actually there is a part of me that is sort of, it's sort of like your mind in meditation, just secreting thoughts all the time. There's a part of me that really is that person who would do that crazy shit. And to relate to that as a part of me is exactly in keeping with what you're saying, the amalgam of selves. And, you know, it leads only in one direction, which is toward acceptance. So that one who is, you know, sober from marijuana and alcohol for 10 years and then finds herself dreaming and smoking a joint, that's an okay part. Like, don't worry. It's okay. Don't worry. Smoking cigarettes in my dreams, like, it's super satisfying. Weirdly, I wake up and I'm like, looking around, did that really happen? I felt it in my lungs.
Yeah.
In my dream. I felt it. I was like celebrating the feeling. Whoa.
The burn and the inhale.
Yes. And, but really, you know, that those substances, those two in particular, have really no place in my life anymore. It's like cheesecake or wheat bread or something, you know, it's not a part of my life.
It just doesn't work.
And to dream about it is to sort of allow the mind to just secrete the possibility and then release it and it's gone.
And what a safe and therapeutic way to do it.
Totally.
And you could say that about many other experiences that occur in dreams that would not be healthy or functional to do in real life, as you said.
That's right.
But these parts, you know, our mutual friend, Professor Douglas Brooks, often refers to the demons in various mythologies, in various traditions, is like, you don't feed the demon, the demon will come for you, and you will pay the price in some form.
It's funny. I'm taking with Douglas now online his History of Buddhism 12-week course.
I just started it.
Amazing.
It's every course
so
he does amazing.
To be back in.
Yeah, right?
Yes. But it's so good to be back in with him and to be listening to him and taking notes. And I even bought one of those electronic notebooks specifically for this course. I'm really enjoying it rather than carry around a big heavy notebook like I used to. But I have to say, learning the history of Buddhism is helping me put my entire arc of learning together, because I started with him 22 years ago.
Yeah.
He was my first philosophy teacher. And we started right in on the Upanishads. And to take the arc, to go back and see where the Upanishads predated Buddhism as we know it, and see how all of those things fit together, like really perfectly. The Vedas, the Brahmins into Buddhism, Buddhism as a reaction to all of that in a way, is so cool. Wow.
So cool and so important to be exposed to historical perspective, to critical observation and analysis of the various claims traditions make. As a side note, that's why I passionately wanted Professor Douglas Brooks as well as Professor Christopher Chappell lecturing and providing class content on GLOW that's philosophical in nature. But back to what I was saying, you know, Douglas reminds us that this process of critical observation is referred to as explanatory reduction. And all of that is so helpful for me. It's a process that helps me develop more of an understanding and appreciation for why traditions started and how they evolved, how they've influenced each other, or as Douglas often says, and I'm roughly paraphrasing here, how they stole and borrowed from each other and how they continue to do so. We humans love shortcuts, and it's so easy and tempting to reduce hundreds to thousands of years of very complex philosophy and practice into something that may not be as helpful or potentially even misleading, you know, without diving into the nuance. For example, he speaks to the rigor of a Buddhist logic and its evolution over time. And I'm only on the first day of the course. So I'm hoping he unpacks that more. So we'll link to that course in the show notes for anyone who's interested in purchasing that. We'll also link to his episodes on mindfulness that he did on the GLOW podcast.
Yes. It's interesting how I'm looking at my notes right now, and I'll say this, unrelenting. I quoted him as saying that Buddhism is an unrelenting, rigorous system of logic, deeply intuitive, but it sees the world as the subject creates the world from how we see, whereas Hinduism is going the opposite direction. The world creates the subject. And having studied Hinduism all this time, that world out there and how it's affecting me, the fact that the Buddhist thinks less of the world out there and more about the creativity that spins the world into existence from my understanding is very cool, very interesting. And really, I didn't really grasp it before I started taking this particular course. And lastly, to sort of put a coda and close that loop, an unrelenting seriousness to take up the suffering in the world and the seriousness of the world. And I really appreciate that. I feel like as I'm getting older, you know what? That's important as it is to bring joy to everything that we do, to do our best to do that, to understand the nature of the suffering and the broad scope of the suffering is equally as important, to see what little things we can do about it and then go to sleep at night knowing we tried.
We're going to touch upon your hospice journey before we get too far from the statement you made. You referred to your redefined understanding or definition of success earlier, and there's another recent Substack post where you say there really is no need to know exactly what's next, what I should do, how it will unfold. Finally, after spending decades chasing after my misunderstood version of success, I'm folding myself into this simple practice to see where it leads. How would does this process of updating your models of success inform your creativity?
You know, the more I sit, the more I find ideas, streamlining systems in my life, simple things. These are not grandiose creations that come through. Although sometimes there are steps towards some creation that I've been thinking about for some time. What I've found is that those quiet spaces of practice really lend themselves to my capacity to be a really good mom, to do my best. And when I screw up, to apologize. A really good partner, to do my best when I screw up, to apologize. A good kid. My dad's still alive. You know, my mom died 8 years ago. A good listener for my mom. She shows up often in the sits. These are not especially interesting or important notions by any stretch of the imagination, but they are the way a day can proceed in a life that has meaning. And that is what the practice gives me. You know, the simple pockets of meaning and value and creativity in whatever I'm doing.
You mentioned people showing up in the sit. Do you, and earlier you mentioned how the dreaming process, the nighttime dreaming process can be therapeutic. And one of your poems titled Pigtails, you say, turning away and returning. Dream, and later on the poem, dreamland forgiveness, the most unforgettable, true kind. Do you see the more you focus on dreams and with these incredibly long sit sessions, I think you've mentioned like 5-8 hour range or realm of sitting duration. Is there some similarity between what happens in those long periods of being with yourself and what one might experience in the dream?
I would imagine. Yeah. It's just more truncated in a dream, but over the course of a day where there's, you know, 5 different hour long pockets of sitting interspersed with walking, working, eating, and no talking, no personality. In fact, you know, a big part of those periods of practice are dropping the whole persona. And it's just like a vast sky. Like, oh my God, anything is possible. There's no phone here. There's no work happening. You know, what's the appropriate response? It's much more available because I am not colored by my phone or some thing that I have to do or remember. And life just keeps getting more simple. And the hope is that that sort of practice, that sort of intensity of practice is setting me up for a level of acceptance as I approach the end of my life in a few years and what that looks like and how comfortable I will be when I lose people that I love or I myself die. You know, how is that going to go? And I think the practice really prepares us for that and gives us all of these sweet moments of presence prior to those endings, which are inevitable. And I appreciate that sort of most of all, I would say.
I think it was towards the beginning of your book, there's a poem titled Held. And different parts say, you write, she tells me I'm never going to be a writer. Beautiful because of her giant mind. Words inhabit her with a fierce, mysterious majesty. Words are at home in her wise, confident body. You mentioned the concept and the experience of dropping a persona. I wonder, and you referred to at the beginning how producing this work and putting it out there in the world is such a revealing, vulnerable experience. I can imagine that sort of internal narrative arc of feeling that, of feeling someone that you, I'm assuming, held an incredible amount of respect for and regard, telling you you're never going to be a writer, but yet here you are writing about that, experiencing and sharing this with the world, and in so doing, dropping, or if not dropping your persona, holding that persona in your arms like you would hold your seven-year-old self.
You know, what's interesting, your reading of it is a fascinating shift for me. The very beginning of the piece, I'm talking about how it's a professor at Cornell, my poetry professor, the first very small section that I had. And she was actually telling me, she made me realize that I can drop my own internal voice that was telling me that I would never be a writer. That's what she showed me. And it's fascinating that you read it the way that you read it.
That's my projection.
Could be. It could also be that it's unclear. But the fact of what this woman did, she didn't even give me such a great grade. I think I had an A minus or a B plus or something, but I really tried my best. And I still have the Norton Anthology of Poetry that I bought that year, which was 1988. Oh my God. Her belief and support and encouragement, not dissimilar to a writer by the name of Nancy Arony, who's still working and teaching today in the public domain. It was all about what is good about this piece, what is beautiful, what is meaningful, what touched you. And all of us felt very held by this human. And that was where, precisely when I started to drop the notion that I would never be a writer. Why would I even have that thought? You know, what's the point of that? Of course, it didn't really happen until many decades later. But I've always loved writing, and I always think of this gal who, you know, she wasn't much older than I, as I mentioned in the piece, but she was just such a force for belief in myself. And it was a game changer. And it I'm glad you brought it up, because, you know, if anyone's listening to this and you happen to be a teacher, a professor, or some support to some young person or people, you just cannot measure the impact of a few words of encouragement and how that will carry forward many, many decades into the future. So I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah, it can be everything.
Yeah, for sure.
You've touched upon the concept of practice many times in our conversation, and I wrote down three notes, three sections from three different poems. I think this might be the last of what I read from your book, if that's okay. The first one, ABC, it takes 90 minutes. By the time it's over, we've released all haste, more light and slowness in our kinder faces. We remember now we'd forgotten again our practice, our medicine. And then in a tribute to practice, holding no tension, expanding again, finally arriving at an agreement with myself. What if your practice is an art form, not a path, but an expression? And then in a tribute to practice, you said, what if your practice is an art form, not a path, but an expansion?
Yes. Yeah. There's a, That's a question that I think we all need to be asking. You know, I don't think there's, as much as I do feel like I'm walking on a certain path, and I'm always choosing where the path is or what the path is, I really think all of this is just the art that we're making in our lives, in our little houses, in our little spaces. And it's not necessarily leading in any certain direction, except to make us more aware of the meaning and the beauty in our world, even when things are really fucking hard. Like, I've had some really hard times recently.
Yeah.
And I still feel full of hope and vigor and trust. And that's really a result of practice. This morning I recorded, because I'm going to be away on this pilgrimage, aforementioned pilgrimage to Japan. So I'm recording in advance all the classes that I'm going to be doing for that time period that are going to be released. So I did a 45-minute level 2-3 intensity 3 flow class, and it was major. And I was like out of breath, and it was great. And I've had this whole morning, it's been a pretty packed morning, and I feel so present for whatever art is being made here and in the previous appointments, one more to come, because of that practice. And it leads me back to, I don't think it's a path. Even though it is a path, I think it's an expression. I think it's just a way forward. I think it's simpler than we think. I think it's more important than we think. And I think it's less special than we think. And I think that's where we can encourage people to do shorter practices, 5 minutes, 10 minutes. My teacher put out a whole deck called In a Moment, In a Breath, with micro meditation practices. You know, what if it was that easy?
As you said earlier, it's the streamlining of the simple things.
Mm-hmm. Boy, because you and I both, smarty pants are us. We have made our lives very complicated at certain intervals, and now we know better. And we're trying our best to keep it really straightforward and simple.
Yeah, at some point you bang your head against the wall enough, you realize totally. That you either need to find another way of doing and living and existing and being with yourself, or it just doesn't end well.
Exactly.
You mentioned hospice, and
yes,
you know, my wife's father passed away, and in the last week, when he was sent home from the hospital, this incredible, lovely woman joined us for hospice. And prior to that experience, I didn't know even what hospice was. I didn't know the definition of the word. And throughout that journey, I then learned the definition of angel. And so when I read that you were, I don't even know what the right phrase is, doing this, helping in this way, I just thought, wow, I have to ask her about her experience with that.
To be honest, I have no idea how it happened. When I took the training that I took specifically for hospice, specifically in this state, specifically with this particular collective, to be a volunteer, I thought, oh my goodness, I have no idea how I got here, but there was no escaping this call. And now I've sat with a few folks, notably James's mom, who recently passed, who chose medically assisted death. And it was absolutely exquisite. And not a lot is required. You know, hospice is a way for, we'll go sort of to the most external, it's a way for all to save money, time, energy, and pain. There's no hospital. When you know that you're within 6 months of your expiration date, as it were, of your death, structures are put in place so that you are never put in an ambulance. You are never put in a hospital. You are just kept comfortable and safe. You are read to, you are cooked for, whatever you need in your home. The process of sort of mapping out the end of one's life whether you're in a state where you can choose to do medically assisted death or not, is so sacred. It's so beautiful. Let's get all your affairs in order. Let's do this in a real sort of simple, orderly, loving fashion. Let's make it easier. The whole thing. I just want to make the whole walk easier for folks. And that's all that hospice is. It was the origin of it was in the previous century in the UK. It started. There, you know, speaking of angels, there are so many angels in this world who are choosing to sit at the bedside of the dying and just bear witness. And it is daunting how beautiful and how inspired I am, how beautiful it is and how inspired I am to do this work. And, you know, I don't really have much else to say other than it's a real honor to be with somebody as they're dying. It's an honor to be with them. They're a month away or 2 months away. There are observable patterns that you can pick up, and you can lend a really beautiful presence and safety to the whole household, including the family members.
So beautiful, so needed. We don't, as a macro culture, really know how to deal with death as it's happening. And
we don't.
Oh, wow. We need you and others. Thank you, Elena. As we explore a topic that deals with the ending of a chapter, and who knows what happens after this great chapter we call life. Let's bring this to a close. We didn't get to parenting. You have what seems to be a lovely course on parenting, which I look forward to taking someday.
You don't need it really until she's like 2, 3. You can start to listen then. I'll send it over.
Okay.
But what I think is really important for you is to keep in mind nothing is personal for all of us. Nothing is personal. When your kid starts to individuate, which is happening in these sort of layers of the onion, it keeps on happening. There are different iterations of it, different expressions of it. I'm having one right now at 17, but that is like the most normal possible sequence of events. And so you can celebrate it. Don't take it personally. Nothing ever that is said is personal. Even the "I hate you, mom," which by some miracle was never said to me, but I think it was felt. Even that is not personal.
Thank you.
And that's an important distinction.
We'll be putting a bunch of links in the show notes. Is there anything you want to maybe share your website? I know everything's available on your website.
Yeah. The site is perfect. Just my name.
Also, I'd love if you have any books that are helpful in one of your recent podcasts, you refer to, you interview some people that, and you refer to some books that deal with that whole journey. And I'd like to read those. Mm-hmm. So maybe we'll include those as well in the show notes.
Yeah. You know what I have? I started this a while ago. People were always asking me for books because I am like crazy as you are. Remember how we've always connected on like the piles of books that both of us have. On bookshop.org, I have a shop page, and all of those funds, you know, it's like $15 a month, whatever, it all gets donated. And I have a list of Zen, of yoga, of parenting, of my favorites for the last 4 years. So everything is there, and I keep it updated. I'm very active there. So
perfect. Well, we'll link to that.
I'll send over that link to you as well.
Thank you. Elena, thank you so much. This was lovely. Anytime I get to spend time with you is just a joy. So thank you.
Thank you so much. I really feel you got to start, and I'll finish by saying this is one of the most satisfying professional and personal relationships in my adult life with you, and of course with Lisa by osmosis. She's become a very dear sister to me, and you are forever a brother to me, and I really appreciate the fact that we get to work together on top of all of that. It's amazing and very special indeed.
Beautiful. Thank you. I feel the same. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you to our entire team behind the scenes at GLOW. I'm so grateful for your care and commitment to serving our members around the world. Thank you to our teachers for so beautifully sharing your gifts and talents. I'm also grateful to our lovely community of GLOW members. You've supported us since 2008, and because of you, we get to continue to do the work we love. It's the combined support of our team, our teachers, and our community that grants me the privilege to continue to bring you the GLOW podcast. Thank you to Lee Schneider at Red Cub Agency for production support. And the beautiful music you're hearing now is by Carrie Rodriguez and her husband, Luke Jacobs. And remember, take care of yourself because our world needs you. Thank you for coming on this journey with me. You can find the GLOW podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or glo.com/podcast, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm Derek Mills.